chillingly cold, calculated murder.
All the dreadful things that you could possibly ever imagine happened to your daughter.
Sorry, goodbye.
My instinct, she was dead that night.
Are you prepared to answer those questions?
No.
Welcome to Inside Crime. I'm Layla McKinnon. When young minds spiral out of control, tonight we look at two young killers who became obsessed with murder. One is a young woman who plotted her neighbour's death in meticulous detail. But first, Matthew Malat. If the name sounds familiar, it's because he's the nephew of serial killer Ivan Malat. It was deliberate and premeditated. A thrill kill.
They wanted to kill someone. They didn't care who.
A callous murder carried out by two teenagers. The executioner, a young man who wanted the world to know who he was. Matthew Malat. The nephew of serial killer Ivan Malat.
Matthew, you're going to be charged with the murder of David Octolani. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
I just think he just wanted to big note himself, like, and be like Ivan and start that evil chain again.
Matthew's accomplice, Cohen Klein, not only stood by and watched this terrible crime, he filmed it.
Who owns that mobile phone?
Me. Matt told me that he just didn't like David for a while. And he just wanted to do it.
Their victim, a young man who thought he was just celebrating his birthday with friends, 17-year-old David Octolani.
Within 4 hours of singing happy birthday, he was gone.
David Octolani died in the infamous Belangolo State Forest. It's a foreboding place, but also a location with a chilling significance for David's killer, Matthew Malat. It was in the Belangolo Forest that his uncle, Ivan Malat, slaughtered 7 backpackers. And we'll discover Matthew Malat was obsessed with the deranged serial killer and wanted to be just like him, to murder just like him.
He said, "I'm a Malat, you know what we do." That says it all, doesn't it?
This is the tragic story of the victim, David Octolani, and the leader, the follower, and the witness, all caught on a mobile phone. Bargo, 100 kilometres southwest of Sydney in 2010. Local boy David Octolani has been axed to death at the notorious Belangolo State Forest.
We got a call. There's been a person killed in Belangolo State Forest, and they think that a person by the name of Malat is responsible. It was one of those times where you sort of check yourself and think that you've been G'd up, but it wasn't the case.
He was a beautiful child. He was never any trouble, and it was very rare that I had to discipline him. He was very clingy towards David and I. It was like we were just like his security blanket.
David was raised by his nan and pop, Sandra and David Octolani. It was an idyllic childhood.
Davey would have been helping me feed the chooks, you know.
Yeah, collecting the eggs, and we miss all those days, yeah, certainly do.
You get those flashbacks.
He used to get out with his grandfather, and his grandfather would have him on the horse or out with the chickens or riding a bike.
If I was welding something together, I'd show him and give him a play with it so that later on in life that might help him choose his path.
David was a shy kid who drew homemade cards on Mother's Day.
Well, he was only 8 years old, and he even went out in my garden and he pinched some of my flowers and he wrapped them up, gave me the card, and he said, "Happy Nana's Day." And I'll treasure that for the rest of my life.
As he grew up, David became more outgoing and grew into a popular teenager.
Sometimes I'd have 8 here and I'd be feeding them They were all good kids, you know.
So he was well known by all the kids and well liked. And then when he got to his teenage years, he, like we all do, want to spread our wings a little bit and want to hold him back, but we used to remind him, say, look, choose your friend.
Matthew Malat was one of those friends.
When he was a little boy, he used to come here and he'd play with David. Matthew was a sort of a loner kid.
Growing up in Bargo, Matthew Malat actually went by his stepfather's surname, Muleman. But from a very young age, he had a growing fixation with his uncle, the serial killer, Ivan Malat.
Then at age 14, he changed his name and officially became a Malat. But it wasn't just in name, he was also on the same evil path to infamy.
Matthew Malat left school, left Bargo, fathered a baby and found some work in Newcastle. But before long, the aimless 17-year-old was back in town, ready to bring even greater shame to the Malat name.
And he goes, you know who I am? I said, I'm sorry, but I don't. He said, you know who I am? And I looked at him and I said, oh, you're Matthew Muleman. And he goes, I am not Muleman. My name is Malat. And I go, since when? And then he started to laugh and he had a really evil laugh. And I just said to David, there's something wrong with that kid. How about you distance yourself away from him? I think he wanted to emulate his great uncle and I think he wanted to be bigger and better. He had a mission.
On the 20th of November 2010, David Octoloni turned 17. While David was celebrating his birthday at his grandparents' place, Matthew Malat was plotting a terrible crime. He wanted to kill someone, and that someone was David Octoloni. To do that, Matthew Malat chose a double-edged axe. And now, ready for the kill, he arranged to meet David in town.
Oh, he said, it's Matthew. He wants me to come over. We're going to go and have a party, a few beers for me birthday.
So David headed into town to celebrate with his mates.
And I said, now have a good birthday. And I said, you promise you'll ring me? He goes, yeah. And he said, OK, Nan, I'll see you. And he smiled and that was it. But little did I know, Malat was waiting for him.
David caught up with his mates on the main drag of Bargo, where they would drink and smoke pot. But on this night, Matthew had other plans. He suggested that they go down to Belangolo State Forest, the infamous place where his uncle, the serial killer Ivan Malat, murdered and buried his victims. In the car were Matthew Malat, his accomplice Cohen Klein, David and Chase Day. Chase Day knew nothing of the murderous plan. He told police he thought they were just going out to party.
David, he got a bit fishy about it and it seemed legit that we'll just go on there to have a good time and nothing was going to happen. Matt was calm, didn't seem angry or anything. I asked him why Belangolo Forest and he's like, oh, it's his birthday, let's go and celebrate. And I was like, all right, well, what do we really need to go out there for? And he's like, oh, I just want to check out these plaques at this park where Ivan dumped all the bodies. And I was like, all right. And that was it.
Just after 9 p.m, the four boys arrived at Belangolo State Forest. Matthew Malat and Cohen Klein went to the boot of the car.
Matt and Cohen were talking at the back and I was sitting where I was sitting. And then I got out, just having a stretch, and then Octo walked around the back and I seen Matt with an axe and I said, what are you doing this for? And David started screaming, like crying, telling Matt to stop. And Matt hit him. And then I go to Matt, I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, you just get in the fucking car and just stay out of it. And I did. And I went and sat in the middle and then Cohen sat with me. And I was keeping my head down. I was listening to Octo just running around, just screaming, just telling Matt to stop.
Please, Matt.
The mats had come in, they took him down to about here, and he said, lay down. Matt, I was like, don't do this, meaning like crying, saying he was sorry.
For 15 minutes, David was tormented and tortured. Then the final fatal blow, an axe to the head.
And that was it. That's all I heard. And I said, I just went silent.
Minutes later, his body was dragged into the forest and covered with branches. At Nan and Pop Octoloni's, Sandra never received David's promised phone call.
9 o'clock came and he didn't ring me, and I thought, well, OK, he's 17, back off.
And he never fronted that night, but we weren't concerned. We just accepted that, you know.
The only people who did know his whereabouts were heading back to Bargo. At the wheel, Matthew Malat was on a high.
If Matt was saying, oh, yeah, that was such an adrenaline rush. That was all I heard him say. And then Matt's like, oh, Colin was like, I told you that you were going to go down the same path as your uncle. And that was it.
The next morning, Matthew Malat knew he had to cover up his crime. So he bundled his bloodied clothes and tossed them into a watering hole. David Octoloni never made it home the night of his birthday, and police had the awful task of informing his grandparents.
I'm just about to pick up the phone and I've got a knock at the door, and it's the police. He said, just please go and get your husband, and that's when he said David had been murdered.
Nothing came out. Stunned into silence, you know. Didn't even burst into tears. I didn't believe it.
Overcome with guilt and grief, 18-year-old Chase Day had come into the local police station and confessed his part in the murder.
Now, it's been explained to you that you're under arrest for your involvement in the murder of David Octoloni. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Day told detectives that, fearing for his own life, he helped Matthew move David's body.
I knew if I was really about ready to freak out. I was ready to panic so hard. And I knew if I panicked, he would have killed me. I offered him help to make it look like I wasn't going to do anything at all.
He told me that he thought that if he made any attempt to intervene, that he would be killed.
And I knew there was a knife in the front seat. I felt like running up there and just stabbing Matt in the leg. Right, so he didn't kill Octo. I had nothing running going. I had nothing going through my head at all. I couldn't think straight.
Chase Day was initially charged to being an accessory after the fact. That charge was later dropped when police accepted that not only had he been an unwitting witness to this terrible crime, he even tried to stop it. But for now, he was in custody along with Matthew Malat, who was also arrested.
I entered your bedroom and I said that you're under arrest.
Yes.
Okay.
Want to handcuff you?
You're under arrest.
36 hours before, David had been celebrating his birthday with his grandparents. Now he was lying in a morgue.
We had to go down and recognised the body. Just the look on his face and his eyes were, you know, you could just tell the face of fear.
Start to cry.
...17-year-old Matthew Malat showed no emotion. He was less than forthcoming with police, and his grandfather, William Malat, brother of Ivan, gave him support during the interview.
Do you agree that I asked you where were the clothes were that you were wearing on Saturday night?
Just don't answer that, Matt.
Okay. What I'm trying to do here is just to corroborate what happened earlier this morning and the questions that I had asked him this morning.
Yeah.
Is it the case that you're not going to answer those questions about what happened?
Yes.
Now, what I'd like to do, Matthew, is interview you about the murder of David Octoloni. Do you understand that? Now, I want to ask you some questions about that. Are you prepared to answer those questions?
No.
Matthew Malat was charged with David Ottoloni's murder. He refused to answer any questions throughout the entire investigation, but detectives already had enough evidence to prove his guilt. The shoes he wore that night had David's blood on them. Malat's murder weapon, the double-edged axe, was found in the waterhole where Malat had dumped it after a bushwalker had found his wallet nearby. But it was the mobile phone seized at Cohen Klein's house that proved the most significant and the most alarming of all the evidence.
Who owns that mobile phone?
Me.
Is that the only mobile phone you have?
Yeah.
It was this admission that would later seal Klein's fate.
I was going to come into the police station this morning, but it got to me before I could get up and come to you.
At the police station, Klein claimed he was just an innocent bystander.
Had you spoken to Matt about harming David in any way?
No, I couldn't do that, especially to a maid.
But police knew that was a blatant lie.
When you were down in the Blangwell State Forest, did you have your mobile phone with you?
Yeah. I was just sitting in the car. Mm-hmm.
And did you use your mobile phone at all while you were there that night? So did you attempt at any time to contact emergency services or anything?
No.
Cohen Klein never thought to use his mobile phone to call police because he was busy using it to film the murder. Every single moment of David's 15 minutes of hell was recorded.
When the technical police were able to recover that file, we were able to hear the offence in all of its horrific detail. That included conversations between Klein and Malat just prior to Ottoloni being hit with the axe.
You have to be ready if he gets away.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was abundantly clear from those conversations that Klein had knowledge of the offence prior to it occurring.
Can you feel the adrenaline?
Yeah. It's George Buchan.
He was there to help Malat become the legend or the notorious figure that Malat wanted to become. This was a thrill kill. I believe Malat chose someone to kill, and it was David.
The two teens, Cohen Klein and Matthew Malat, were now facing murder charges.
Matthew, you're going to be charged with the murder of David Ottoloni. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
Confronted with the damning evidence of the mobile phone, both Cohen Klein and Matthew Malat pleaded guilty to the murder of David Ottoloni. But before the judge handed down the sentences, Malat passed her a note saying he was sorry.
I have known and been friends with David and his family for years and pray that this is a bad dream. Sincerely, Matthew S. Malat.
It was a terrible lie, because while in custody, he'd also been penning a series of poems gloating about the murder.
Hear the crunch of leaves and feet. Feel your heart skip a beat. Are you gonna get away? No hope, kid. This is your day.
I'd like to jam every bit of paper down his throat and hope he choked on it, but how could you? Not even hardened killers gloat about things like that.
The judge wasn't impressed either, but unlike his uncle Ivan, Matthew will be released. Malat received a minimum sentence of 30 years in jail. On appeal, Cohen was given a minimum of 20 years.
I honestly think Malat should have got life, and I think Klein should have got life. I hope they rot in hell, because they've not only destroyed us, they've destroyed their own families as well, you know.
All I know is that karma takes over. I'd never forgive them. I'll never forget. And I just hope that someone else balances the books. You know?
the hardest part is, like, we raised him and all of a sudden he was just, after celebrating his birthday, within 4 hours, he was gone. We'll never see him again.
I'll be doing something and it'll come back to me that I did this with David. I just have a flashback to if David was there, you know.
And David was such a trusting soul. You know, he never thought bad of anyone. So he was just lured to his death. But to me, they just wanted to make a big name for themselves. And Milat jumped on the bandwagon of Ivan and he wanted to be bigger and better.
He said, I'm a Milat, you know what we do. So it says it all, doesn't it?
How beautiful, grandson.
It'll kill you. You'll eat yourself away inside if you dwell on it all the time. They're just not part of my life anymore, but David is. And always will be.
Our next story also highlights the obsessive compulsion to kill. Caroline Reed Robertson was so infatuated with her talented and beautiful neighbour that she maliciously took her life, a murder she'd been plotting for years. Fatal obsession.
This is, without doubt, one of the most bizarre homicides that I have worked on.
The girl next door. Her jealous neighbour. The bizarre teenage fantasy.
To actually want to kill the role model and replace them. I mean, that's going really a long way.
That turned deadly.
Rachel wasn't perfect, but Caroline thought she was.
In the leafy suburbs of Melbourne, Caroline Reed Robertson was consumed by a crazy obsession with her neighbour, pretty, popular dance student, Rachel Barber.
Hello, Rachel.
But she didn't want to be like Rachel Barber. She wanted to become Rachel Barber.
Without doubt, one of the most bizarre homicides that I'm aware of or have worked on. It is skin-crawling, chillingly cold, calculated murder.
For 5 years, Caroline Reed Robertson waited and secretly plotted. And one day, Rachel Barber simply didn't come home.
I was panicking. And you think, why panic? She's 15, but I felt really uneasy. I felt really, really uneasy.
This is the chilling story of Caroline Reed Robertson, the twisted 19-year-old who found the perfect victim in Rachel Barber, the pretty girl down the road.
Happy Christmas, Rachel.
Caroline Reed Robertson and Rachel Barber lived on the same street in Montalbert, a comfortable middle-class suburb of Melbourne, Victoria. That's where the similarities ended. Caroline's home life was deeply unhappy. The parents were heading for a breakup. She was shy, reclusive, moody.
On the face of it, Caroline was fine. She had a quiet personality. But what happens inside a house is often not seen outside of the house.
Rachel Barber was the exact opposite. 4 years younger than Caroline, her home was full of love and joy. And she was happy, outgoing, athletic.
Ballet was always her first passion, and Rachel would come home at the end of the day and our whole house would be dismantled. And she'd get all her dress-ups out and she would just improvise. And there would be full-on performances.
Although they lived just 100 metres apart, Rachel Barber and Caroline Reed Robertson had little to do with each other. But when Rachel was 10, Caroline came over to babysit. Even then, she was already fascinated by her young neighbour. Over the next 5 years, this fascination with Rachel festered inside the troubled Caroline Reed Robertson. And it soon became a fatal obsession.
I think that Caroline was very unhappy with herself. She didn't like the way she looked. She did want to take on that persona of someone that was happy, that was beautiful, that was popular, like Rachel was, and try and live that life. You and I can sit here and say, well, that's just not possible, but certainly that's what she wanted to do, and that is absolutely my belief of why she took Rachel's life.
Caroline Reed Robertson was a very unhappy teenager. Her house was a war zone. Her parents' marriage was over, and she was in constant conflict with her mother and two sisters.
I've got to go now. Sorry, goodbye, goodbye. Hey, come here.
Here we were, mum and dad and three daughters, you know, happy. And then across the road, she has three sisters, mum and dad. Dad's left home, family unhappy. So from that regard, she might well have wanted to wish that she could have something like what we had.
Some people might change their behaviour, their appearance, their job, their lifestyle, so they can be like their role model. But to actually want to kill the role model and replace them, I mean, that's going really a long way.
Caroline's behaviour became more and more extreme. She was full of self-loathing and anger. In desperation, her mother Gail shared her fears with Rachel's mum, Elizabeth.
I had Gail crying on my shoulder for her grief over worry for her daughter. And she said, I can't do anything. And I'd say, take her to see somebody. And she said, I've tried that. She doesn't want to go.
Instead, Caroline retreated into her own world, writing tortured letters to her father, David, who'd since moved out of home.
Obese, pizza face, white worm, massive nose, and just plain weird. I feel like a tortured, troubled soul. Signed, Spotty Dotty.
Well, sometimes you start off with a process of fantasizing, and then, you know, that compulsion becomes stronger and stronger. And then if you don't start acting on it, then you just feel this terrible discomfort. And that's what motivates people to do things that they shouldn't be doing.
When Rachel was 14, the Barbers moved to the outer Melbourne suburb of Heathmont. The family thought they'd seen the last of their strange neighbour, but they were wrong.
We were living our lives, they were living theirs. So we were oblivious to anything that Caroline could have been planning. Rachel would have been spied on quite a few times because she was keeping an eye on Rachel a lot. You know, she had photos of all of us girls all over her walls. I mean, that's crazy.
Reed Robertson kept notes about the 15-year-old, saying she was strikingly attractive with a dancer's body and hypnotic green eyes.
Wild, free spirit. Passionate, charming, moody, mysterious.
It's hard to know exactly when Caroline Reed Robertson decided to murder Rachel Barber. She had already gathered enough information to assume Rachel's identity, including her birth certificate, and she'd rented a one-bedroom apartment in Prahran while working for a mobile service provider. Now all she had to do was lure Rachel to her home.
She was thinking about this for a couple of years, or even if she wasn't thinking about it, it was in her subconscious. One of the homicide detectives sadly said that he really honestly believed Rachel's days were numbered.
She wrote of plans to disfigure her, made up a new name for herself, and intended to assume parts of her victim's identity.
With people who lack conscience, they will see the victim as someone who, by their own fault, is in the wrong place at the wrong time and deserve what they get.
In early 1999, Caroline Reed Robertson contacted Rachel Barber out of the blue and told her about a modelling job that could earn her some much-needed money. But Rachel's mum intervened, telling her she was too young. A few months later, Caroline tried again, Only this time she told Rachel not to tell anybody because she would be paid well to participate in a confidential research study.
I said, you're up to something. I said, what are you up to? And it was almost there. And she said nothing. And she waited for her father, and then she was fine, and then they went off and she waved goodbye. She said, I love you at the end, and that was the morning.
It was the last time Elizabeth would see her daughter alive. That afternoon, Caroline met Rachel after her dance class, and they caught the tram from Richmond to Paran, just 100 metres down the road from Caroline's unit. It was 6:40 p.m. Back at her unit, Caroline asked Rachel to meditate as part of the research study. As Rachel sat with her back to Caroline, she was attacked. Caroline choked Rachel with a computer cable from work.
Rachel pleaded for her life, and I think to myself, the last person she saw in this life was Caroline. And Rachel would not have been able to understand why Caroline would be murdering her. I think she would be completely... There would be no logic. There's no logic in this death.
When Rachel was a no-show at her regular pickup point, alarm bells went off.
When Michael rang me up and said Rachel wasn't at the tram stop, I was panicking. And you think, why panic? She's 15, but we knew something was wrong because she wasn't home.
I knew instantly. I knew, because I just had that gut feeling because it wasn't Rachel. Rachel wasn't someone to just disappear. There's no way that she'd want to run away or anything like that. It just wasn't her. So my instinct was she was dead that night.
Rachel Barber is missing, and with each passing minute, her family's fears for her safety grow.
We want Rachel back. She's missed. We love her.
Didn't see Mum and Dad much at all because they were always out on the road, in the city, putting up posters.
I felt really uneasy. It was very unusual for her to do this.
We have grave concerns for her welfare at this point in time.
Rachel told her boyfriend she was doing a job that would earn a lot of money.
Rachel's disappearance was big news.
She's a kid that will not go with anyone she doesn't trust.
And soon police had a breakthrough. A witness had seen her and another girl getting off the tram in Paran.
Really critical information. And the girl who had this sighting was someone that knew Rachel, that had been to the same school as Rachel.
With a reliable sighting, police set about finding a link with Paran. And they soon discovered it. The night before she disappeared, Rachel took two calls from a Paran phone number. It was Caroline Reed Robertson's number.
Rachel spoke on the phone with a defendant the night before her disappearance and was seen getting off a tram near Robertson's home on the day she vanished.
At that point, very cruelly so, Michael actually believed that she was alive. And he thought for whatever reason, Rachel was with Caroline, but the important thing would be that she would be alive, that she hadn't been kidnapped, that she hadn't been raped. All the dreadful things that you could possibly ever imagine happened to your daughter.
When police visited Caroline's unit, there was no answer. Inside, they found her semi-conscious on the floor. Somehow, their arrival had triggered an epileptic fit. But there was no sign of Rachel. Caroline Reed Robertson was brought to the Alfred Hospital. And a few hours later, police were able to speak to her. What she told them in an unemotional, almost matter-of-fact way, shocked them to the core.
I asked her where Rachel was, and she responded to me that Rachel was dead.
A detective investigating her disappearance said Robertson admitted the crime. She allegedly told him, "She's dead, I killed her, it was an accident."
And I said, "You know, are you sure she's dead?" And she said, "Yes, I've buried her." And I said, "Listen, are you sure? Are you sure that she's dead? Is there no way we can help her?" and she told me that she'd buried Rachel on a family country property near where she'd buried other pets.
After arresting Caroline Reed Robertson for the murder of Rachel Barber, detectives searched Caroline's family farm at Kilmore, 70 kilometres northeast of Melbourne.
Police found notebooks at Robertson's flat detailing intentions to kill the teenager. The notes refer to plans to drug Rachel, disfigure her body and place it in an army bag. They also explain a plot to give her pizza laced with a powder causing drowsiness and place a toxic cloth over her mouth.
Carolyn clearly planned this out. This was a premeditated murder. But it's not spur of the moment, and it's certainly not passion.
The next morning, detectives searched Caroline's family farm at Kilmore, 70 kilometres northeast of Melbourne. Here, they found Rachel's badly decomposed remains in a shallow grave, just where Caroline told them they'd be.
Neil sat in front of us, and he said, "There's no other way of saying this. Rachel's been murdered." We're all very calm. And I kept thinking, why couldn't Rachel have done something? Why couldn't she have thrown a chair through a window? Couldn't she have done something?
She'd been strangled with insulating cable and had taken an antihistamine which impaired alertness.
I did ask them who did it, and they told me it was Caroline. I was shocked but not surprised, really, in any way.
From here on, police struggle to get any more information out of Caroline. She was vague, unresponsive, evasive.
It's unbelievable that she would not recall what had occurred or know that she was involved in the murder of Rachel. Caroline's very cold. Very matter of fact, but just very cold. There's no emotion there whatsoever. Calculating.
Despite Caroline's almost total lack of recall, the case against her was overwhelming. There was her meticulous murder plan, her obsessive diary entries about Rachel, the fact that Rachel was strangled with a computer cord from Caroline's work. What's more, Rachel's remains were buried on Caroline's family farm. And then, of course, there was her confession. Caroline Reed Robertson was charged with Rachel Barber's murder.
I've never come across another one of those. I'm not saying that they don't exist, but they are so rare out there. Very strange.
Caroline Reed Robertson's court appearance was a deeply emotional experience for Rachel's family.
I have seen a photo of that noose. I know it could have been let go right at the very end when she said Rachel was pleading, please, please don't.
Bizarrely, after confessing to police, Caroline decided to fight the murder charge. Then, at the 11th hour, she pleaded guilty, denying Rachel's loved ones a trial and the answers they so desperately wanted.
Maybe in prison this is where she'll get the special help that she needs, but it doesn't take away the tragedy that she's destroyed a beautiful life.
This unusual case in which a young woman killed a teenage friend out of jealousy stumped even a seasoned Supreme Court judge. Justice Frank Vincent admitted sentencing Caroline Reed Robertson was difficult, but after thinking deeply about it, he decided to send her to jail for 20 years with parole eligibility after 14 and a half.
In his sentencing, Justice Frank Vincent said this was a difficult task because everyone had lost. But ultimately, no one had lost as much as Rachel Barber, from whom he said Caroline Reed Robertson took everything.
Nothing is ever going to bring Rachel back, and it doesn't mean that I'm not angry, but I think sometimes you can be angry but be philosophical about it.
Hello, Rachel. Doesn't she look elegant?
It's now more than 15 years since Rachel Barber was murdered. The terrible thoughts of her final moments never really fade, but there are so many more happy memories, and that's what her mum tries to remember.
When Rachel was murdered, her life couldn't have been better. And she was at a point where she totally believed in herself that she was doing her dancing and everything was going to be right for her.
I've got to go now. Sorry, goodbye.